This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. More today on Mayor Marty Walsh's decision to accept and adopt all of the recommendations made by the Boston Police Reform Task Force. Among the recommendations, a new diversity and inclusion unit, an independent civilian oversight office with subpoena power, more police body camera usage. Now, yesterday we heard from a member of the task force. Today we will get reaction from a reformer and from the president of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association. We begin with Shigun Itowu. He's the executive director at the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts and co-founder of the Boston Police Camera Action Team. Shigun, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I just want to start by asking you for your reactions to the recommendations from the task force.
Well, you know, we, at BPCAT were extremely hopeful and happy with the recommendations that the task force put together. You know, everybody who was on that task force put in so many volunteer hours to talk to members of the community, both who have had negative experiences with police officers, but also who have been advocating for a lot of these issues for now decades. So we were happy to see that they took the bold step to ensure that everybody's voice was recognized in that report and had no shame or fear of putting that on the mayor's desk and saying, now the ball is in your court to actualize all these things.
So the ball is in his court now, and he embraced all the recommendations yesterday, set essentially a timeline of 180 days for implementation. Are you optimistic that all of the recommendations will happen and in that time frame?
Well, you know, I don't want to get ahead of that actual time frame. So I will be happy to come back on the show in 180 days to share, you know, whether or not, we've actually stuck to that timeline. I mean, you know, of course, I'm grateful that the mayor has embraced all of these recommendations, has not tried at all to wiggle out of doing certain recommendations and committing to others. But, you know, I'm also very, at least at BPCAT, we're very used to press conferences and commitments to making things come about. I mean, it was several years ago that the commitment was made to equip every officer with a body camera. And unfortunately, that had to be another recommendation in this report because it hadn't happened yet. So, we are hopeful that we will, meet that timeline. We're cautiously optimistic, I guess, is the short answer to that question.
So let's stay that with for a second longer. Where are overall the pressure points or the pain points that you might anticipate as an activist and a reformer in getting all these recommendations implemented?
Well, I think one of the major pain points is coming after this conversation. We don't yet know where the police unions stand on these reform measures. We don't know what the internal issues may be to actualizing all of these recommendations. Of course, you know, at BPCAT, and I'm sure those on the task force stand at the ready to work with the mayor and others to, make sure these things come about. But I think the greatest struggle will be with ensuring that the unions are in favor of these reform measures and not blocking these needed reform measures as they did when we were simply trying to bring about body cameras that their own membership supported. But we're hopeful, we're looking forward to the conversation after this to hear that that they're going to support this as much as the mayor does.
And I think you're referring to the conversation I'll be having with the head of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association as soon as you and I are done speaking, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so former city councilor Charles Yancey, he spent more than three decades pushing for a police oversight board, and he called these recommendations a baby step toward what he had envisioned. He expressed a couple of worries, one that the board won't be truly independent from the police department or city hall, since all of the appointees of an oversight board would be made by the mayor. And he also said there would be real challenges to leadership if, as you've mentioned, the police unions refuse to cooperate. I want to talk about this piece about appointments in particular. Can an oversight body that's appointed exclusively by the mayor enforce appropriately in your mind and get implementation done?
This is the conversation we're having on a macro level in the city as well when it comes to things like the school committee, even where folks are indicating or arguing that a body that is completely appointed by a singular entity cannot truly be independent. And so, you know, I would say that Councillor Yancey, who I have the deepest respect for, and you're right, has been pushing for this for decades, is correct that, you know, the mayor having all the power, and I should, you know, note that this is not a Mayor Walsh thing, but thinking of the office itself, being able to appoint all of the members of this body, you know, can be concerning. And so, you know, I think that the what Councillor Yancey had pushed for was at least making sure that the city council also has the ability to make appointments to this board so that there's shared power there. And of course, you know, I'm sure the councillor would be open to elected positions on such a body as well to ensure that true democracy is alive on this independent body.
Shigen, transparency and accountability are themes that are sounded kind of throughout these recommendations. In particular, the task force recommended that the police proactively track and publish data on success of the implementation on outcomes rather than responding to information requests, for example. As someone who's thought in this area for a while and been engaged in activism for a number of years, what kind of specific information would you like to see available and tracked?
So, you know, one of the things that folks have been pushing for is, you know, racial data, gender data. We want to know who you're stopping, how many times, in what areas of the city, things like that, I think are going to be critical to our understanding just of policing overall and how that happens, but then also, you know, using that data to define what the solutions are to addressing any disparities that exist. I know that, you know, groups like the ACLU and others have been pushing for that. So we'll hope that that's embedded in the data that they determine they're going to collect.
And what should the outcome of that data be? You know, accountability implies not only the transparency of information, but then either consequences or rewards, depending on where the data comes out. What do you want to see there?
Well, you know, one thing that was not in the task force report was one of the major cries from protesters in the street. I mean, I was at all the protests and at all of them, people were calling for defunding, which was, you know, taking away money from certain parts of the police department and investing it in the community. And so for me, when I'm thinking of the data that we're collecting, you know, I want to also see how many of these stops were mental health, you know, calls and responses, how many of them, you know, were actually for something violent, because I think that data allows us to also shape, you know, how much money do we need to invest in more police officers versus investing that in mental health care workers to respond to situations. So, you know, those are the things that I'd like to see the data being applied to. And to your point about consequences and things of that nature, you know, yes, you know, it's going to be important that we're holding people accountable for their missteps and for abuse of power. You know, for me, the reward for officers for doing their job is what all of us get at the end of the week, which is our paycheck and the knowledge of doing our job well. But, you know, again, those are all the things I'm thinking about for how we're using that data appropriately to respond to what that the masses of people have been calling for, which is not just the reform measures that, again, you know, we're happy that have been embraced, but the fact that we are shifting investment to community programs.
I do want to note, too, Shigen, that the task force did include some language saying, for example, quote, the city should identify, strengthen, and expand services that appropriately serve and support the BPD in shifting responsibility in responding to instances involving persons experiencing homelessness, substance use, mental health, end quote. So there is a little there. So just briefly, last question for you. What most encourages you from these recommendations?
Well, for me, it's who informed the recommendations that was important for me. So the fact that you had folks like Darren Howell and Jamal Crawford, you know, Jeffrey Brown, et cetera, involved in shaping these recommendations, for me, was a step forward in terms of how someone in the position of mayor uses their position. Oftentimes, we see some of the same folks who are helping to make these decisions, or really just putting a rubber stamp on what an elected official wants. And so For me, the overall important piece of this was in who was making the decisions, who was informing, what the next step should be. And then, again, the mayor deciding to embrace all of these reforms and not trying to find a way to not do so. So for me, those were the positive things. The reform is important, but as all advocates know, the work is not yet done. So even though these reform measures have been embraced, this isn't it. There are other things that need to happen to ensure we have a responsible and accountable police department.
That is Shigan Itowu, Executive Director at the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts and co-founder of the Boston Police Camera Action Team. Shigan, thanks.
Thank you.
So let's turn now to the president of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, Larry Calderoni. He's been with the Boston Police since 1994, joins us on the, over the line today. Larry Calderoni, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me, Zoe. I appreciate the time on the air, and I'd like to say hello to my friend Shigan. We've had some past interaction together, so if he's still listening, I'd like to say hi to him as well.
That's great. And I, you were talking with Zoe a minute ago. This is Tiziana now, and I'm glad that you were able to hear Shigun's comments there. It gives us a basis for talking a little more about these reforms. I'm glad to have you, and I want to start by asking you what the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association makes of the recommendations.
I apologize about having the name wrong. I'm sorry.
No, not at all. Listen, don't worry about it at all. I'm going to ask you the same question I started with Shigan, which is your overall reaction to the recommendations.
Well, I have a hard time commenting on the overall recommendation because we don't really have a background of knowledge in anything that took place in the backroom conversations, the open air conversations. We were only involved once with the committee. And that was an online dialogue that they had that was open to the public. So we don't know too much about all of the requests that are here. For some reason, the union did not have a seat at the table, and we're looking at creating reforms or a change in the way that we can make policing better. The Patrolmen's Association is all about making policing better. We believe we're one of the best in the nation already. I keep referring to President Obama's accolades back in 2015 that look no further than the city of Boston when you want to learn how community policing's done. So our men and women on the street are doing a great job every day. But if there's a better way to do it, we're open to that conversation. We're just a little disheartened that we weren't included from the onset. So I can't really make an educated or concise comment on these so-called reforms because we don't have any basis of knowledge for them.
So I want to come back in a minute to the question about inclusion in the process. The recommendations from yesterday aren't substantially different than the draft recommendations that were released earlier in September, around mid-September. I'm assuming that you have seen those, and so maybe we can go back and ask what the reactions were to the draft recommendations that came out about a month ago.
Yeah, we can talk about the draft recommendations, certainly. Unfortunately, I have to tell you that I have not received any answers to some of the questions that we put forth. Like they talk about this new OPAT panel with investigatory and subpoena powers.
But one of the general Office of Policing Accountability and Transparency, just for our listeners so they know what you mean by OPAT. Please go ahead.
Yeah. To this day, I still don't know what kind of investigators they're going to hire, what their background is, what their experience is. You talk about subpoena power. No one can tell me if they're attorneys, if they're schooled, what the educational level is. We have no information to go by, so it would be inappropriate for
what
me to make comments.
What would you like to see there? Yeah, so what would you like to see there, Officer Calderoni?
Oh, I'd like to see experienced law enforcement personnel doing the background and investigations, people that know what policing is all about on a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week basis. It's hard to put civilian personnel in a position of such an enormous amount of power to say that they're going to investigate complaints that come in sometimes anonymously and give them the ability to perform investigations behind the scenes and not know what their experience level is. You look at it like this. I take a lot of common sense approaches to it. If your refrigerator is broken, you're not calling the electrician to come figure out why the AC unit isn't pumping. So why are we doing that with policing?
Well, you know, so there's repair and then there's oversight. I do think reasonable people might argue that we have a number of other professions where oversight includes not only members of the profession, but others who are affected by the profession and should have a voice in that oversight as well. Any thoughts or reaction to that?
Yeah, actually, I agree with you probably 99.9% there. When you look at the Bar of Attorneys that oversee attorneys that practice law, that panel is made up predominantly of people in the field, that being attorneys. When you look at the medical profession that oversees practicing physicians, it's made up of over 70% doctors on the panel. So again, why are we treating police officers differently? It seems punitive to me. It looks like there's an axe to grind from, as was said earlier, negative experiences with police officers. Undoubtedly, people have had negative experiences with police officers. We understand that. However, that doesn't mean that we should punish everyone and paint them with the same brush. The men and women of the Boston Police Department do an outstanding job every day on the street.
So there's a lot more I know that we could talk about there, but there are a number of other things I want to make sure I get to with you, Officer Calderoni. I want to ask, there were two officers on the task force, Eddie Crispin of the Boston Police Department, and he's president of MAMLEO, which is the Massachusetts Association of Minority Law Enforcement Officers, and Superintendent Dennis White, who's the chief of staff of the BPD. You expressed some concern that there was insufficient representation or understanding of the police perspective on the task force. Did you not feel that those two officers could represent the interests of police in those discussions?
Well, let me be clear, first off, because it didn't sound like your answer was the same as mine, respectfully. To start with, Sergeant Eddie Crispin and Superintendent White, both excellent officers, friends of mine, exemplary of what you would want in policing today. If you dial 911 or if a loved one in my house dialed 911, I would want both of those officers to show up, just to tell you how great I think both of them are. But my point that I was making earlier was, the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, the union that represents the 1,600-odd police officers, the men and women on the street every day, we did not have a voice at the table. And when I hear the rhetoric that seems to always dominate conversation, that if the union doesn't stand in the way, if the union doesn't hinder progress, it's pretty hard to point the finger at the union when we don't even have a seat at the table. Some input would be appreciated. As you can hear the frustration in my voice, it's downright disrespectful. How can people say that the union is hindering progress when we don't even have a voice at the table? We don't even know what's being discussed.
Did you specifically request the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, did you specifically request to meet with the task force, or did the task force reach out to you?
At no point in time did the task force reach out to us, nor did we seek out the task force, no.
Okay. I want to talk about the body camera issue for a minute. You were reacting a minute ago to both the conversation we had with Shigun Itowo just before, and he has been active on body cameras for police, as well as, I think, that sort of the broader conversation there. I know you know that people are watching and wondering how the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association is going to react to the recommendations around body cameras. The union sued the city over the original policy. This would increase body camera usage. Do you plan to counter the new recommendations as well, and are the courts a piece of that for the union?
Well, it's kind of a multifaceted question you have, so bear with me. First off, when the past union leadership went to court over the body cameras, I was not part of the past union leadership that did go to court, so I can't sit here and second guess what they did. I'm going to have to sit here as the new union president and support them in the direction that they went. But not pretend to know what was really behind it. And as far as the new body cameras or the extension of body cameras coming out, our experience has been so far that the body cameras exonerate more officers than not. It seems to us on the street that more often when body camera footage is downloaded and viewed is that the offender seems to be proven to be doing something that he or she should not be, to say it in a professional way. And the accusations tend to be false against the officer. And what's really bothersome to that is that no one is ever charged with filing a false police report. No one is ever charged with making false claims against the officer. And once again, this is somebody who's experienced some type of negativity by meeting with the police, and their first reaction is to file a false claim, thus trying to hurt the officer professionally. And it's just not right. People that are filing claims against police officers, they should be held to the same standard as everyone else. You file a false claim, which is a crime, you should be charged and prosecuted.
So thank you. That actually gets to a question I might have asked. I think you've just answered it about recommendations you might have wanted to see that weren't there. We're running out of time now. I want to thank you. Larry Calderoni is the president of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association. I want to thank you for taking the time today, and I hope that you will come back and talk with us again as we continue to follow this issue.
Always. I'd be delighted. Thank you for the time.
Appreciate the time. The Breath of Empty Space examines police brutality and racism. The exhibit, now at Mass MoCA, exclusively features work by Brooklyn-based artist Sean Leonardo, who uses manipulated charcoal drawings to reinterpret images of black and brown men and boys who have been victims of police violence. The drawings include representations of widely shared images showing the beating of Rodney King, the body of Michael Brown, and others. There are also drawings of Freddy Pereira, a 21-year-old killed by the police in Queens, New York, in 1991. In that case, there was no direct visual evidence of the violence, but Leonardo found a way to show it.
Because there were no eyewitnesses, or supposedly no eyewitnesses, I had to draw from the medical examiner's report, and I searched and sourced images that could explain to me what happened to this young man.
It is not meant to be comfortable viewing, and the exhibit didn't come to North Adams without controversy. It was meant to go to Cleveland's Contemporary Art Museum, but that showing was canceled after black activists and museum staff objected to the work, saying it would be traumatizing for the community. One of the activists who objected was the mother of Tamir Rice, whose image is used in the work. That experience reinvigorated Leonardo's commitment to what he sees as the necessity of his art. When we reached him, I started by asking him about the impetus for this work.
Well, the first drawing in the series actually followed nearly a year after the killing of Trayvon Martin. And I will be entirely honest with you, when I first started working with this material, it was for no one other than myself. I needed to find a way to be able to look into Trayvon's eyes without any of the media distraction, without any of the accompanying noise. I wanted to just be able to grapple with the fear that was emerging in my body, in my psyche, knowing that someone as young as Trayvon, that his life could be so easily taken away, and so much of what I had clearly buried from my own upbringing had come surging back, particularly because it was at a time when my wife and I were considering having a child. And so I looked at Trayvon and understood that that fear would have to be transferred over to whomever I brought into this world.
So this brings up one of the things that was on my mind in looking at the images of the artwork and of the exhibit itself. The exhibit itself is this long hallway, which looks, it looks like a gauntlet, like this long gauntlet that you walk. And the images run down this gauntlet. And we often have a narrative of each one of these as an instance, the George Floyd killing, the Trayvon Martin killing, the Tamir Rice killing. But in fact, it's a story of history. These aren't moments. This is an arc of a story that not only was playing out when you did the art, but played out violently and repeatedly in the months since the exhibit went in. Does the exhibit have a different feel to you now after this summer? And do you want people to walk this gauntlet of history of violence?
Absolutely. I think that was intentional. And I would say it feels different in the moment, of course, that where we find ourselves in the ways that it feels ever more so charged and more present in our lives. But it depicts a historical legacy of this violence. And much of what you see is the ways in which it is not contained to police violence out in the streets, but that it plays out in the courts. as is conveyed in the work with the Central Park Five incident. And what I hope for is that we have to better understand the systemic reasons behind these moments, these tragedies, that they are interconnected. And what I'm asking the viewer then is to understand how they might be complacent in their looking in the ways in which it becomes a flash of emotion for some of us, but then subsides. And that to enact real social change, it requires us to look deeply and read carefully into the ways that they are interconnected so that we understand that there are specific systems, structures that uphold violence or the ways that violence can be enacted against Black and brown bodies.
I want to move now into some of the controversy around this exhibit, The Breath of Empty Space. It's at Mass MoCA after the Contemporary Art Museum in Cleveland canceled it, after a group of local Black activists and museum staff in the city objected to the work. There are a number of issues in that. I think the thing I want to ask you about to start is, when one shows images of someone's violence and trauma, it raises questions, I think, two that I'd love to hear you reflect on. The first is, how does one have to be careful in the way of presenting those images to make sure that we're not touring someone else's trauma? And then two, how do we decide who owns those images and can use them?
And that's an absolutely incredibly important debate and valid question. And I think they're interrelated. So I will actually answer those in the opposite way than what you asked them. I would like to propose that there is a way in which, if we are asked to collectively absorb these images and the ways in which they are circulated and such so widely disseminated and then repeated in the media, that it is a collective trauma as well. And so the question of ownership, of course, is a sensitive one. But I also like to pose alongside that it's a question of responsibility. Who's responsible to these images? And so to your first question, I'd like to make the distinction between a representation of the images as we receive them from the media and a work of art that offers a different type of opportunity of sitting with the image and processing it in such a way that one might gather more meaning and one might actually find an opening toward healing. And that's a very different proposition. And I agree, the ways in which proximity to any of these images, context around these images, our responsibility, the ways in which it is being presented and hosted, all of those things lead to a worthy debate in terms of how any of my work and any other work that deals with and works through traumatic imagery, how it should exist in the world. But my point of view is that the art should be at the center of that debate. And so the very last thing we should do is cancel out the work, because it is the work that will lead the path toward the healing. And we will not be able to find that space unless we engage the trauma directly, and unless we hold on to it, engage it, and grapple with it.
So how do you, and I understand you work with an independent curator, John Chase, how do the two of you engage with museums, which are historically white-funded, white-run, and too often made comfortable and available to white communities and not communities of color? In situating the exhibit, in engaging with community on it, I believe there must be some way that you believe that part must be done in order to ensure that people sit with the discomfort of these images in the way that you feel they must.
Absolutely. And what it requires is a real felt relationship with the individuals that make up the institution. We often forget that in these systems, these institutions, that they are made up of people. It's assessing the willingness and openness and engaging in difficult conversations, not solely as a museum, but as the individuals within the museum. And therefore, finding ways for the staff and leadership to move closer to the work. And that is as much part of what is being described as community engagement as any outreach effort. And so plotting ahead with John, the independent curator, and developing a relationship of trust is crucial in creating a space of care and accountability to Black and Brown audiences, BIPOC audiences, because if those within it are not able to see themselves and implicate their own whiteness in their seeing, then they will attempt to remove themselves from the work. And it's always been important to me that they become part of the process in engagement. And I think that is ultimately what failed in Cleveland, that they enacted a process without me, without my voice.
Why do you feel that Massmocha and North Adams are prepared to engage with and embrace this exhibit? And why are you comfortable that the experience you're seeking, that people will have it this time around?
I think it's important to acknowledge that my relationship with Massmocha has started years ago. And so it stems from that relationship. It stems from that openness and willingness to engage the work and the necessary difficulty in bringing people in with care. And so it didn't really come as so much of a surprise that they were able to step up and willing to step up in such a heartfelt way. And so the negotiation, if I'm going to call it that, actually occurred rather quickly because there was already a foundational trust there and ways in which they have been working to expand themselves out into the nearby communities and invite the tension in. And that is what this work deserves.
You said a few minutes ago, Sean, that you wanted to ensure that people would not remove themselves from the art. One of the things that is most striking to me in looking at the art is that you have removed things from the pictures. There are six pictures of Michael Brown under a shroud, but in I think it's two of them, his body's gone. In the Central Park Five, it's a court drawing, but we only see pieces of it. The Rodney King drawing is so haunting because the police, and you can see them in physical action, but the space where Rodney King would be is a white void. Why remove pieces of the moment? What is the thought there?
So it goes back to this original notion that I proposed, that there is the difference between representing the image as we once saw it and utilizing the image toward a different kind of opportunity. And I think it's in these various strategies that you're describing, which can only be really felt and seen when you're in the physical space, that implicates our looking differently. And so, for example, the Rodney King drawing is a perfect example in which we are so ingrained with the image of that beaten Black body that so often we miss the fact that there were 11 officers at that scene. There's a relationship, a direct correlation between what survives in our collective consciousness and the choices by the media. And what I'm asking viewers to see is their own complacency in what they receive and what and how we remember.
My last question for you, Sean, in just a few words, what conversation would you want people to have when they leave the exhibit?
I want this exhibition, this work, to show us that we can internalize these images differently and that it can have an impact on how we conduct ourselves every day with one another. Whether that moves us toward activism or some other kind of action, what I'm saying is that there's a direct determination in the way we look and the way we act and the way we bring meaning to this history of violence. So I want people to have a moment of self-introspection to understand where they sit today in 2020 and the change that is being called upon for all of us. And it starts by the way that we look at each other and perceive each other's identities.
That's artist Sean Leonardo. His work is now on display at Mass MoCA. The exhibition is called The Breath of Empty Space. Sean, thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak to the work.
And you can see Sean Leonardo's work at Mass MoCA through December 22nd. A year ago, polls showed Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey down double digits in the fight to protect his Senate seat from Democratic challenger Congressman Joe Kennedy. Some prognosticators actually thought he might just step aside. Well, he didn't. Instead, Markey beat Kennedy by 11 points in last month's primary, thanks in large part to a wave of support from young, progressive voters and a savvy social media operation. Next up, general election and a challenge from Republican attorney Kevin O'Connor. We'll be speaking to both Senate candidates here on the show, beginning today with Senator Ed Markey. Senator, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So, Senator Markey, you've served in Congress for over four decades now. I think it is fair to say that your public persona as an elected official in both the Commonwealth and the country is markedly different than it was, say, 6 years ago or 12 years ago. Do you feel you have started a new chapter? Are you different in some way?
Well, I don't think that my position on issues has changed at all. So, for example, I've been the leader in Congress on climate change for years. The author of the legislation to increase the fuel economy standards of the vehicles which we drive, which is still the largest single reduction in greenhouse gases of any law ever passed in any country. I'm the author of the law increasing the efficiency of appliances, you know, air conditioning, refrigeration, also a dramatic reduction in greenhouse gases. It obviated the need for upwards of 200 coal-burning plants to ever have to be built in our country. So I'm very proud of my work over the years. I think what happened was that when I introduced the Green New Deal with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in order to start a movement to make sure that we took the urgent action which is necessary to deal with the crisis, it created much more political attention to the issue, but it didn't reflect a change at all in the views that I had expressed. And in fact, to a certain extent, my achievements in the past were the basis for a whole new younger generation of activists to then join in a partnership with me in this race because they knew that there was an authenticity to what I had been doing throughout the course of my entire career on that issue. And the same thing is true on gun safety legislation, on healthcare provisions. So I think to a certain extent, it's not so much reinvention as much as being rediscovered as someone who had worked on these issues over the years.
Is that enough to... Okay, let me backtrack. We are in a time of such generational disconnect that the phrase, okay, boomer, right, is one of the phrases of the last couple of years. And yet your support is so strong among young people. Is your backing of the Green New Deal, is that enough to explain that? Or do you think there is something else going on that is worth paying attention to and learning from?
I think that the Green New Deal is a part of it, but I think that the more that young people came to learn about my successful efforts to beat the NRA, to have the CDC do research on the causes of gun violence in our society for the first time, and it's beginning this year, and I was successful on that, when they learned about my work on racial justice issues, criminal justice issues, my partnership with Senator Cory Booker on those issues, I think it just reinforced an overall portrait of who I am. And so when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said in reference to me, it's not your age, it's the age of your ideas, I think it became very clear to people that I was the youngest person in the race when it came to ideas, and that's why young people rallied to my side.
I have to ask you, there are a number of other issues important to young people, and of course, no one Black votes as a single Black. People are diverse and have many interests. But you know, you did vote for the 1994 crime bill. You voted for the Iraq War. You opposed busing to desegregate Boston schools early in your congressional career. Those moves would likely not be something that would be attractive to a young, really progressive base. How do you square that circle?
Well, I think it was very clear that that young people today did not care about votes 40 years ago, that I made clear that I had changed, and I had changed 40 years ago. So they were looking for someone who was a leader on the issues that are confronting their generation today. And when they look at those issues, it was very clear to them that I was a leader in some areas and the leader in other areas for the Senate, for the country. And what I found is that on climate change, young people really do feel that they've been left with a problem that has been created by preceding generations. They could see very clearly that I was the leader, along with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, in starting a movement to deal with it. And they knew that I had been fighting the fossil fuel industry, other special interests, the automotive industry, the utility industries over the years. They could see how staunch my support was amongst environmental groups and how much I was opposed by the polluting companies. And so it gave them an insight into who I am. They rallied to my side again and created a new situation where we can actually see Vice President Biden now adopting many of the positions which we have been advocating for in the Green New Deal. And it's because of that partnership, the activism of young people joining with myself and AOC.
So let's stay with that, because your challenger, Kevin O'Connor, says that by supporting things like the Green New Deal, you are alienating moderates and conservatives, which contributes to gridlock in Washington. You just mentioned the vice president. In his debate with President Trump, he did parse his support for environmental reform versus the specific Green New Deal pretty carefully. Does that show that O'Connor has a point?
No, it doesn't, because he supports Donald Trump for president of the United States, and Trump is the denier in chief. And the last thing we need is for Massachusetts to send another vote to Washington to help Donald Trump and his climate policies. By the way, his climate policies are roll back fuel economy standards, roll back energy efficiency standards, roll back protections for the environment, build the Keystone pipeline, ram through pipelines through the state of Massachusetts, where there is overwhelming public objection to them. So that's where Kevin O'Connor has planted himself politically as a supporter of Donald Trump and his policies, whereas the Democrats are united on climate change. We believe in the science. We believe that urgent action must be taken. And Vice President Biden actually has asked Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the Sunrise Movement to be partners with him in drafting the new proposals, which he has released, which, by the way, include reaching 100% renewable electricity by the year 2035, which is very consistent with the Green New Deal. So enormous progress has been made. We're united. We believe in the science. We believe that we need to take urgent action. And we believe that we can create millions of new jobs. The Republicans are trying to defend the old coal burning, oil generating issues. We're trying to create a whole new generation of renewable energy jobs by the millions, and to make sure that minority communities, frontline communities, are at the front of the line to get those jobs and to have the new facilities be constructed in their communities.
So we will, Kevin O'Connor, your opponent, does say he doesn't support all of Trump's policies, but we will press him on that when we have the conversation with him. I want to talk about a different policy issue that there is daylight between you and he on. We've been talking about police and police reform for the rest of the hour earlier on this show. O'Connor says that police have been undermined by calls around the country for disarming and defunding. You have called for disarming police of some weapons, such as tear gas, rubber, and plastic bullets. And that has angered police unions, including the Massachusetts Police Association, which used to support you, but now accuses you of being, quote, out of touch with the American people, end quote. Where do you stand on law enforcement and police reform today? And we have about 3 minutes left in our conversation.
Okay, thank you. Well, I'm supportive of Mayor Walsh's decision to increase police accountability, which he has just announced, because I think a good cop is a better cop in a system with accountability. And the protests that we've seen in the wake of the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and so many others, they're calls for justice. And so I'm glad to see that the city of Boston has responded to the calls from protesters for police reform. And I think that those steps are important, but we also need national steps as well, because there can be no true justice without police accountability. We need to end qualified immunity so that bad officers are held accountable and victims of excessive force can get justice. And I've introduced legislation with Ayanna Pressley in the Senate, partnering with her in the House to do just that. I think we need to create a national police misconduct registry to collect better and more accurate data of police misconduct and use of force. We need to stop problem officers from changing jurisdictions to avoid accountability. We need to end racial and religious profiling. We need to ban no-knock warrants in many instances. We need to ban chokeholds and neckholds, the kind that killed Eric Garner. So we need real fundamental change in our criminal justice system. We're 5% of the world's population. We have 25% of all the prisoners in the world are behind bars in the United States. Not Russia,
so
not China,
Senator,
in the United States, 25% of all prisoners. We need fundamental criminal justice reform.
We have about 30 seconds left. In that 30 seconds, we are in a global pandemic, and it has fundamentally shifted something in so many of us. In our last 30 seconds, Senator, what is something that has fundamentally shifted in you?
I would say that it's very clear who the essential workers are. They're Black, they're brown, they're immigrants. And that they are much more exposed. And Chelsea is a good example with this very high incidence, but they're so close to the pollution. Underlying asthmas lead to more vulnerability for coronavirus. We owe those essential workers help. And when we win this election next January, we have to put those essential workers right at the front of the line to get the benefits which they've earned by helping all the rest of us. They can't Zoom to work
Thank
the
you.
Way most of us can. They had to show up and take the risk. And now we have to pay them back by giving them
Thank
the
you.
Kind of help that they need for their families.
Senator Markey, thanks so much. That's Senator Ed Markey. And that is our
Thank
show
you.
For today. Tune in tomorrow for more Radio Boston.